Finally today, our usual wrap-up of interesting stories from our daily news site. Science news reporter Lauren Shankman talks with online news editor David Grimm.
So, Dave, what's the first story you've brought for us today?
Well, Lauren, this first story is about a sort of mind meld that happens when two people talk to each other.
So what do you mean by mind meld?
We're not talking about a Vulcan mind meld here. We're talking about how people's brains synchronize with each other when they talk. This is a theory that's been going around among psychologists. And the old theory about conversation used to be, you know, if I'm talking to you and you're listening, then only the listening parts of your brain are active and only the talking parts of my brain are active. But recently, psychologists have thought that's too simple a picture. They think something a lot more complex is going on. They say, you know, when people talk to each other, they start to imitate each other. Like if I start talking really loud, you might also start talking really loud. Or if I'm gesticulating a lot when I talk, you might do the same thing. So the researchers think, you know, there's got to be a lot more synchronization happening between people's brains when they talk.
Well, how did they test that?
So what they did in this study was they had a graduate student sit in an MRI machine. And this is a machine that measures activity in different parts of your brain. And she related a 15-minute story about her high school days, about boys fighting over her to take her to the prom, and also about a car accident she had. And then what the researchers did was they put 11 volunteers in MRI machines, and they had them listen to this grad student's story. And what they found was that when areas of her brain lit up, when she was talking about certain parts of the story, the same parts of the brain lit up in these volunteers when they were listening to the story. They were actually having the very same parts of their brain turn on, as it were, as the speaker had.
So how do they know that's not because they were just listening to someone talk?
So as a control, the researchers had a person that speaks Russian relate a sort of a similar story, and none of the volunteers could speak Russian. And what they found was that when the volunteers listened to the Russian speaker, their brain regions didn't activate the way they did when they listened to the English speaker.
How long was the delay between some part of the speaker's brain activating and some part of the listener's brain activating?
Well, it really varied. Sometimes the same regions activated at the same time. So if the graduate student was talking about the car accident, maybe a particular part of her brain lit up under MRI. And when a listener heard about the car accident, that same exact part of their brain lit up at the same exact time. But not always. Sometimes, in fact, part of the frontal lobe of these listeners actually lit up right before the frontal lobe of the speaker would have lit up if these guys were actually having a face-to-face conversation. Our researchers say that may indicate that not only are listeners listening to a conversation, but they're actually trying to anticipate what's going to happen next. And by our frontal lobes lighting up, we're sort of predicting what the other speaker is going to say next. And this really all flows into why conversations are so easy for us. You know, we take conversations for granted. You and I are having a conversation right now, but there's actually a lot going on in the brain when this happens. And the researchers say all this mind melding that's going on actually allows us to have an effective conversation. It's not just me talking and you listening, but there's a lot of anticipation going on. There's a lot of me reading signals from you while you're listening. And all this together makes communication and social interaction a lot more pleasant than it probably would be otherwise.
So the next story you brought is about a traffic jam in space. Is that right?
That's right. Lauren, this is all about gridlock that happens in orbit. It turns out that a lot of the satellites, and we've got hundreds of satellites up there orbiting the Earth, a lot of these satellites are in what's called geosynchronous orbit, which means that they are always over the same part of Earth at the same time. And the reason you'd want something like that is if, especially for telecommunication satellites, they have to communicate with satellite dishes on the ground. And we don't always want to be readjusting the satellite dishes on our roof every 2 seconds when the satellite moves. So the idea is we can always point these dishes at the exact same part of the sky, and that satellite's always going to be on that part of the sky because it's in geosynchronous orbit. But it's not easy to get into geosynchronous orbit. In order for satellites to be in this orbit, they actually have to orbit around the equator due to the laws of gravity. And not just around the equator, but actually in a fairly narrow band around the equator. And you can imagine if you've got hundreds of satellites up there and they're all jostling for this very narrow orbital band, there's going to be a lot of traffic and there's going to be a lot of congestion. And we're not there yet where there's total gridlock, but scientists are sort of running out of real estate up there to put these satellites.
So what can we do to make more room?
Well, that's a great question. That's what researchers have been trying to figure out. One idea that's been floated is, well, just put rockets on these satellites that allow them to maneuver into different orbital positions. And the problem with that is if you maneuver outside of this equatorial position, you're in a much less stable orbit, which means you're not just automatically following the same point on Earth all the time, you always have to keep on readjusting to make sure that you're following the same point, and you got to correct your orbit more because this orbit's less stable. And what that means is you're spending a lot more money on rocket fuel. And when these rockets die, the satellite dies. So a solution like that isn't really feasible. It's too expensive, and it's not really practical. In this new study, the researchers said, well, can we find something that's a better solution? And they turned to something called solar sails. And the idea is the spacecraft can unfurl these mylar sheaths in space, which sort of act the same way a sail would act on a sailboat on Earth. But instead of catching wind, because there's no wind up there in space, they would actually be catching photons from the sun. And even though these photons are incredibly tiny particles, if you've got enough of them, the idea is that they can actually exert enough force on these mylar sheaths to potentially blow a satellite around. And if you had that, you've got all this natural energy from the sun. You don't need to worry about rockets. You don't need to worry about parts breaking down. All you have to do is have a satellite unfurl its sails and drift into different orbital positions. And the idea is, maybe by adjusting its sails, the photons would always keep on blowing, for lack of a better word, to keep that satellite in that position so it wouldn't drift into a less stable orbit.
Well, can they actually do this yet?
Well, there's actually a Japanese spacecraft called Icarus, which is testing the solar sail idea right now. It actually unfurled its sail a few weeks ago. But everything the researchers are proposing in this study is all theoretical. They based it on some very complicated mathematical formulas. And actually, this idea had been proposed by a scientist a while back, but he didn't have the sophisticated computer tools to prove that this idea would actually work. And that's what researchers are doing in this study. They're showing that not only was this a good idea, but it's actually practical.
So what could technology like this be used for?
Well, in addition to alleviating some of the congestion around the Earth's equator, researchers say if we can put these geosynchronous satellites in different places around the planet, which hasn't been possible before, you can imagine putting a geosynchronous satellite above the poles, for example, to measure climate change, and it would always be trained at the same spot. And the idea is that you could get a very accurate reading of a specific part of the planet, say maybe a slice of Antarctica, that you wouldn't be able to get as easily with other satellites.
And our last story is about rubber bands and how they roll. And I'm wondering, how on earth do you get a rubber band to roll?
Well, that's a really good question. And actually, the researchers used something a bit like a hamster wheel. They had this large metal cylinder that spun around, almost like an oil barrel rolling down a hill, but it stayed in one place. So you got this barrel sort of rolling around. They stuck the rubber band inside and increased the speed.
And why were they doing this?
Also, another very good question. The idea is that, you know, physicists have solved a lot of problems, going all the way back to Galileo, when he rolled a bronze ball down a hill and figured out all the forces that act on this ball to increase its acceleration and everything like that. But balls are pretty easy objects. The physics gets a lot more complicated when you're dealing with so-called elastic objects. These are objects that, as the name implies, they're much more flexible.
Well, why would we want to know what happens to an elastic object?
Well, the reason is because there's a lot of phenomena that involve elastic objects. You could be talking about anything from how volcano lava might flow on Mars to that inflatable emergency exit raft on airplanes. There's just so many things that we deal with and that physicists are curious about that aren't as simple as a ball rolling down a hill.
Okay, so what did they find when they put the rubber band in the drum and set it rolling?
And you can actually see a video of that on the site. What they found was that the faster the rubber band rolled, the more it started to compress. All these forces that keep a rubber band rolling, forces like centrifugal forces and the stiffness of the rubber band and even the effects of gravity, all of these things sort of act on the rubber band while it's rolling around. What the researchers found is the faster it rolls, all these other forces actually overwhelm gravity, and the rubber band starts to collapse in on itself. And you can see this in the video. In fact, the rubber band can collapse so much that it starts touching itself, and it can fly right off the wheel. But what the researchers were trying to do is, well, first of all, they found that out. But then the researchers actually developed a model to explain everything that was going on with the rubber band. And that's really what experts say is the interesting part of the study. They say, yeah, it's fun to watch a rubber band roll in a tube, and it's kind of cool to see what would happen if you made a rubber band essentially roll down a hill very quickly. But what's really important here, they say, is this model that's describing what's happening, because they say that they can use this model to describe some of the things we were talking about earlier. In fact, one of the researchers says that he can imagine designing a car that the faster it goes, the more it deforms and less friction it would have with the air. And you can imagine a car getting even more aerodynamic as it goes faster. It's pretty far in the future, but at least models like this allow physicists to envision these kinds of things, which they really didn't have the formulas to describe before.
So what other stories are you looking into this week?
Well, Lauren, we've got stories about how smoking marijuana distorts time. People who smoke pot tend to sometimes say that they feel lost in time, and researchers have figured out potentially what's going on, and also a story about ancient viruses hiding out in our DNA. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about a data leak that happened earlier this week that revealed that there may be a lot more Earth-like planets out there than we previously thought. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Lauren.
Science news reporter Lauren Schenkman talked with online news editor David Grimm. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.